For many years at the Jewish Theological Seminary, there was a professor whose name was Zucker. He was a pretty formidable scholar. He was well known in rabbinic and medieval literature. And even though he stood not even 5 feet off the ground, he was also known for being a pretty fierce teacher. And one of his students, who was my teacher, told me one day he was walking with Professor Zucker to the seminary, and Professor Zucker was saying, "This year's students, they're the worst I've ever had. They're worse than last year's. They're worse than the year before." And a student said to him, "Professor Zucker, look, I don't mean to contradict you, but you say this every single year. Every year you say your students are the worst you've ever had." Professor Zucker paused for a minute and he said, "Yes, but this year's are so bad that they are worse than next year's." And I thought of that when I thought about preparing a sermon for today. Because first of all, as you all know, there's probably not a rabbi in America, and certainly not a rabbi in Israel, and probably not in Europe, who isn't speaking about the situation in Israel. And one of the things that animates the desire to speak about it is exactly that fear. That next year will be worse. And really, I want to give 3 separate sermons. They're all short. But here's how I want to begin. And this is the least comfortable part in some ways. What I want to say is that at the beginning, as a human being and as a Jew, you have to be genuinely saddened, not perfunctorily saddened, but genuinely saddened at the loss of life on both sides. Don't forget that the last time Israel went with ground troops into Gaza, 1,400 people in Gaza died. And I'm not talking about Israelis who died. Children have died and probably will die. Palestinian children. They're not enemies, they're children. A 10-year-old girl who was hit by a missile as she went out to buy milk for her mother is not an enemy, she's a child. And ours is the tradition where the angels started to rejoice as the Egyptians who enslaved us for hundreds of years, Egyptian soldiers, remember, were drowning in the sea, and God said, "Don't rejoice while my creations are dying." So if we don't stop for a minute and feel the genuine pain and sadness of the people who live in Gaza. I'm not talking about the leader of Hamas for whom I shed no tears. But there are children, and they didn't ask to be born in Gaza. And they didn't make this situation. And they are suffering, and they are dying, and we should feel the tragedy of that reality. And anyone who says to you, and I've said this before, but I will say it again, yes, children are dying, but remember, every time you use a sentence that includes a but, it invalidates everything that comes before. And that's why it's a separate sermon. The first sermon is, you should feel the pain of those who are innocent and who are suffering and who are dying, even if they are part of a group that we largely define as enemies of Israel. Please don't dismiss that. It's part of being a human being, and it sure as heck is part of being a Jew. In our tradition, again and again and again, we are told, Nivra Adam Yechidi, God made one person at the beginning of creation. to tell you that anyone who saves a life saves an entire world, anyone who destroys a life destroys an entire world, and it doesn't say destroys a Jewish life or an Israeli life, it just says a life. So take a moment, separate from all the other issues and all the other causes, just to feel the tragedy of people who are dying. This is war. That's the first sermon. The second sermon is a sermon about this country. I know, and you know, that this is a congregation that has all sorts of political opinions. I think that's a good thing. I don't think that's a bad thing. But I'll tell you this. In terms right now of the institutional military cooperation between the United States and Israel, the Iron Dome system that was a joint project of the two countries that has stopped now many missiles, and as I was walking around, Irwin Fields handed me a card that said the fifth Iron Dome system has now gone up over Tel Aviv and has already succeeded in destroying incoming missiles. In terms of that, all we can say is God bless America. Because you realize that however great Israel's military might, that's how small it is and how isolated it often feels in the world. And especially at a moment like this, when that historic alliance, which has had its ups and downs, is most needed, it is there. Now we're on to the third sermon. I believe that sooner or later, most of the people in the region know, eventually, what the general contours of peace should look like. But I also believe that, in fact, the general contours of peace presuppose not only two peoples, but two governments of peoples that want to get to that peace. I want to lay out for you in a second just how difficult Israel's situation is right now. It's true, it is the dominant military power in the Middle East. But, it has a Syria that is imploding, a Libya that is uncertain, an Egypt that is ruled today by the Muslim Brotherhood, who knows tomorrow? An Iran that is seeking a nuclear weapon. And in addition to all of that and more, people within the state of Israel, on its borders and in its borders, who would like nothing better than to see it destroyed. I don't care how many missiles you have, how many planes, how much power. If you care for Israel, that must strike fear into your heart. That's why I began with the story of Professor Zucker. Because whatever is going on in Israel now may, and I say this with trepidation, it may be a prelude. There is so much that is uncertain and is volatile and is frightening in the situation in the Middle East, that as much as we wish to be optimistic, It is very hard to be optimistic. Demographics alone are overwhelming when you think about the fact that there are between 5 and 6 million Jews and literally hundreds of millions of people who surround them who wish they were not there. And realize that the wishes go from velleities, which is like a slight wish, doesn't really interfere with my life, but I wish they weren't there, all the way to I would destroy myself to destroy them. That's a terrifying, terrifying reality. If your children live in Israel, or serve in the army, or raise their children there, knowing even as much as you can live in denial when you sit in the cafes in Tel Aviv, although no longer, even if you can live in denial, in the back of your mind, it is always there. It is, if you will allow me, an analogy that very much, as you know, touches my own life. It's like living in remission. Do you think every moment of every day the cancer could come back? Of course not, otherwise you can't live. But does it always exist inside you? Of course it does. That's the reality of your life. And this is the reality of the life of the people in Israel. That every single day, their vigilance can't be relaxed because they are surrounded by people who, given half a chance, would destroy them. By people who think nothing of firing missiles into schools or on buses or in cafes. Because the principle is, and if you don't know the principle, you should, everyone who lives in Israel is by definition an occupier and therefore by definition an enemy. So a cafe is a legitimate military target, and so is a school bus. That's the reality. And the attempt to try to surgically, carefully, thoughtfully defend yourself without massive force, without wholesale destruction, is extraordinarily difficult. Just imagine, as I have asked people before, just imagine if all of a sudden a government of fanatics took over Texas, intent on destroying the United States. What do you think the military response of this country would be? A couple of surgical strikes? Some targeted assassinations? I suspect you would see the biggest mobilization of forces inside the United States since the Civil War. So it is a very difficult situation. Having said that, we are not permitted to finish with hopelessness. We're not allowed. After all, the reason that the state of Israel was established wasn't because we thought that the world couldn't wait to help the Jewish people. Even though there was this brief moment of history when they could be shamed into it. But if you believe for a moment that there is a surfeit of goodwill towards Israel, then my suggestion to you is start reading the European press. And you will see not just criticism, but a sort of nasty hostility towards the very idea that there is this strong Jewish state in the Middle East that refuses to be subdued. So what do we say and what do we do? Knowing that there is no solution, not today, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next week, maybe not next year, maybe not in the next 10 years. We look to the Torah portion. That's what we do. We see if it tells us something that might make us feel a little bit better about the reality of what our sisters and brothers, our children face as they look around at a hostile world. You will remember in this morning's Torah portion that Jacob steals the birthright from Esau and then runs away. We talked about it in the Torah lesson this morning. And he runs away because Esau swears that when his father dies, he will kill Jacob, whose name, as you know, in the Bible, is changed to Israel. Jacob swears, "I will kill Israel." Esau swears. And there's every reason to believe him, not only because Esau, in his nature, we are told, is wild, but also because he nurses a deep, unquenchable grievance that will not go away, because Jacob will always have the birthright and Esau will never get it back. He'll never get it back. Jacob will never give it up. Israel will never give it up. And 20 years later, after Isaac has died, Esau comes to Jacob and he comes with 20,000 men. Obviously, he has come to fulfill, now that he can, the promise that he made to destroy Israel. And next week, in the Torah portion, when he sees Jacob, when he looks into the eyes of Israel, Esau falls on his neck, embraces him, and weeps. I have quoted him before, but each time I come to this Torah portion, I remember the beautiful interpretation of my father. Why, he once said, why is it that Esau has changed? Because, he said, remember, in the ancient world, people did not see themselves. There were no mirrors. There was no glass. There wasn't the constant sense of how you looked, your hair, your eyes, your clothes, the way that we are familiar with our own appearance. This is new. In the ancient world, people didn't constantly pay attention to how they looked. They couldn't. Now remember, Jacob and Esau were twins. They did not look alike. We know that. Esau was hairy, Jacob was smooth. We know they didn't look alike, but they were born at the same moment. Which means that they were the same age, both when Jacob ran away and now 20 years later. And Esau looks at Jacob and he realizes for the first time, as he looks at himself, how old he has gotten, how many years he has wasted in hatred, how much useless anger and recrimination has eaten away at his heart and embittered his life. And so instead of killing him, he weeps with him. It's a beautiful idea. And it happens sometimes. It happens sometimes, even now, even among enemies, that people will look into the eyes of Israel. And instead of seeing the other, they will see themselves. It is not easy. It's why I began the sermon the way I did, because we must do the same. Try to look into the eyes of the other and see ourselves. And pray. And pray that the spirit of Esau and Jacob, Esau and Israel, can touch those who now wish only to destroy us. Miracles happen in this world. They do. We are about to celebrate Hanukkah. Remarkable miracles can happen. Some worker in the temple left that cruse of oil behind because he believed one day it would be dedicated again. Yaakov went out to meet Esau because he believed maybe his brother would see a brother and not an enemy. We pray for the people, the soldiers, the defenders, the leaders of Israel, that they be granted with wisdom and safety, that all the people in the region know peace. And we hope that maybe the prophecy of the Torah, that one day people will look into each other's eyes and see an image of God, might take hold in that beautiful, sacred, and sometimes darkened spot of land on God's great and promising earth. Please rise for the prayer for peace.
Ready not Israel.
Shabbashamayim, Rock and Redeemer of the people Israel, bless the state of Israel with its promise of redemption. Shield it with your love. Spread over it the shelter of your peace. Guide its leaders and advisors with your light and your truth. Help them with your good counsel. Strengthen the hands of those who defend our holy land. Deliver them. Crown their efforts with triumph. Bless the land with peace and its inhabitants with lasting joy. And let us say,
amen.
Please be seated.